Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Samach Aleph Amud Bet. It lines up. Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Elazar, ribit kitzutza yotza biyadayanim." That means that if you are engaged in charging of interest that is deemed to be interest min haTorah, where the examples we brought in the Mishnah, the Gemara, so if that happens, yotza biyadayanim, the courts have the ability to go after that money, extract it from the individual, and force them to return it. Avak ribit, eino yotza b'dayanin. On the other hand, if it is only ribit midrabanan, the courts don't have a right to interfere and force him to return the monies. Rabbi Yochanan amar, afilu ribit kitzutza, nami eino yotza b'dayanin. Rabbi Yochanan believes that even ribit midoraita, once it's done, it's done, the dayanim cannot interfere or cannot demand that the person return the money to the person from whom he took it. I'm Rabbi Yitzchak, my time with Rabbi Yochanan. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan's position? Damar Kara. The Pasuk in Yechezkel says, V'neshech Natan, V'tarbit Lakach, V'chai lo yechye, et kol ha-toevot eila asa. So there the Pasuk tells us that the individual here who is a Rasha, an evil person, so what are the things that he engaged in that makes him into an evil person? He says, V'neshech Natan, V'tarbit Lakach, he's a person who was involved in charging interest and involved in taking loans with interest. Therefore, he will not live. Lamita nitan v'lo l'heishavon. The Pasuk in Yechezkel tells you that that punishment or what this person will suffer is a death penalty min hashamayim, but there is no obligation of returning it. Ravada ba'ava amar amakra, the Pasuk says, al tikach mito neshech v'tarbit bi'areita melukecha l'mora nitan v'lo l'heishavon. So again, the pasuk that says that the repercussions of neshech and tarbit are v'yareita melukecha means that it's subject to mora, but not subject to return. The Balei Tosafot point out that the understanding over here of, according to the Rivan, is that when it says the mora nitan, sheyesh lo lachzir miyirat shemayim, v'lo l'heishavon al pi beitin. So he suggests that the Rivan suggests that there is an obligation to return it because of Yirat Shemayim, but not because of the court's interference or a normative legal compulsion to return the money. So it would be some sort of, let's say, Tidei Shemayim in a sense, but he thinks that the Rivan thinks that there's an obligation. The Balei Tosafot reject that understanding. And when they say it's Nitan the Morav, Lo Leishavon, it means the Gamre. There's no obligation to return it whatsoever. The separate question, which the Rishonim argue about here, is there an obligation, let's say, Tidei Shemayim? And the Balei Tosafot, there are other Rishonim that say that there is no, let's say, Tidei Shemayim over here, there's no obligation to return it because he gave it to you willingly. Yes, you're in violation of the Isur. But once he gave it to you and you have a Kinyan on it, there's no obligation to return the money. There are other Rishonim that indicate that there is a mitzvah, let's say, Tidei Shemayim, to return the items. That's according to Rabbi Yochanan for when you're in violation de'orait of ribit tzutza. And then even for Rabbi Elazar, when you're in violation of avak ribit, there still may be a, let's say, yidei shemayim that you should return it. Against the way that we saw that the Rivan explained it earlier. Rav Amar, migufei dekra shmele. We learned this out directly from the pasuk. Mot yumat damav bo'yeh. So this is a continuation by the pasuk in Yechezkel. In Yechezkel, yudchet yud gimel, this is the continuation of the pasuk, which says that motumat damov boyeh, that this person will die. He is liable for his own blood. Hukshu malvei ribit l'shofchei damim. There is a hekesh here drawn between people who lend with interest to those that kill. Mashofchei damim lo nitnu l'heishavon. Just like by killing, there's no way to reverse what you've done. Af malvei ribit lo nitnu l'heishavon. So too, when it comes to the paying of interest, there's no way to reverse that which you have done. So, interestingly enough, Rashi takes this a step further. You could have just looked at this as a allegorical parallel, which says that just like by killing, there's no ability to return it. That's just a physical impossibility. So type of milvei ribit, there's no obligation to return it. But Rashi takes it a step further and says that lending with ribit is the equivalent to shvichat damim. But she says over here, Klomar, damim sheshafach, the blood that he spilled, sheha'ani et chavaro umeid berav. He caused his friend to be impoverished and die from starvation. the charging of the interest. Remember, I mentioned this in the introduction to the Perek. The type of loan that we're speaking about in a Torah is someone who's lending money for basic necessities, essentials. This is someone who's taking advantage of a person in a difficult circumstance and lending money in that case. And here they're taking advantage of an ani. And so Rashi says that literally the shvichut damim is what's going on here by the milvei ribit. It's not just simply, oh, it's an allegorical connection. Literally, you're taking this guy's life by charging him interest when he's in such a desperate strait that he's borrowing from you, and your charging of interest makes it impossible for him to return the money, or very difficult for him to return the money. So that's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan's position. We had three versions of how to explain it. The first one from the Pasuk in Yechezkel, which says that it's Nitan Lemita Velo Leishavon. The other one from the Pasuk in Vayikra, that it's Nitan Leirat Shamayim Velo Leishavon. And then we had the third pasuk, which went back to that pasuk in Yechezkel and said that it's compared or essentially the same as shpichut damim, and therefore it is not nitan leishavon. You don't return it. All right. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak, my time at the Rabbi Elazar. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Elazar? Now, truthfully, Rabbi Elazar doesn't have to explain the psukim that Rabbi Yochanan brought, because those are not the pashtut of the pasuk. Those are nice drashot or asmachtot. But he doesn't have to retort to the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan. We simply need to know, what is Rabbi Elazar's position? Damar Kra, the pasuk says, V'chei achicha imach, that your brother should live with you. It is the end of the pasuk in Vayikra, which says, Al tikach mito neshech vitarbit, v'yareita me'alukecha, v'chei achicha imach. So he says, based on that, hader lei keichi denecha imach, you should return it to him so that he can continue to live with you. Again, when you're talking about taking the ribit from someone who's impoverished in desperate straits, then you should give it back to him so that he succeeds at living with you. You give him the opportunity to live with you. So he sees the view of chei achicha imach, the requirement to return it so that he should be able to live, that he should be able to succeed. And so therefore there's an obligation for you to return the monies that you took for interest. Now, the truth is that you can see here at the beginning of the sugya that there's a cross-reference to a Gemara in Tmura. The Gemara in Tmura is speaking about a machloket abayin rava with regards to whether when someone takes an action that the Torah says is asur, is that action able to take hold? Is an efficacious action? Or when the Torah tells you it's asur, you cannot do that action. It's as if the action doesn't exist at all. So here would be what seemingly is a classic case of that. And the Gemara brings this machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar and says it seems to be similar to this machloket Abayin Rava, which is that they're arguing over here as to whether when you charge interest, are you successful at charging the interest? If you are successful at charging the interest, even though the Torah says it's asur, then there may not be any obligation to return it. You made a kinyan, you were successful at acquiring the money from the individual, you just violated the Torah's isur. On the other hand, if you believe that when you go against a precept of the Torah, your action is invalid, then, like Rabbi Elazar would be suggesting, is you charged interest, but it didn't work. So you are in possession of something that belongs to someone else, and therefore you have to return it. You have gzeilah because you were unable to make a kinyan. The Torah says you don't have a right to do that. So the Gemara suggests that that is the machlok between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar. The Gemara rejects it and says that's not the case, that their machloket is not dependent on the machloket of Bayin Rava, but rather on the interpretation of the pasuk v'chei achicha imach, which we're going to see in a second, is the machloket here between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar. We saw Rabbi Elazar's view of it. In a second, we'll see Rabbi Yochanan's view of what v'chei achicha imach is. So the Gemara in Tmura shifts back to what our Gemara here is saying, which is that their machloket is in the interpretation of psukim, not about whether when you take an action against the Torah, you are successful at doing such. Now, what's interesting is that if you believe that it was considered to be theft, the Gemara in a second is going to discuss whether the children have an obligation to return it. Children who inherit interest from their parent who took the interest illegally, do they have an obligation to return it? We see that they don't have an obligation to return it. If you believe it was really gezel, if you believe it was really theft and the parent never came into possession of it properly, then why should it be that the children don't have to return it? It would almost be incumbent upon them to return it because their parent never got possession of it. The Gemara in Baba Kama suggests that the reason they don't have to return it is because you have Shinei Rishut and you have Yayush. In that, at that point, once it's gone from the payer of the interest to the person who is the recipient of the interest, that's already Yayush because he assumes he's paying it. Then you have Shinei Reshut when it goes from the parent down to the child. Shinei Reshut and Yayush grant a kinyan to the individual. That's how the Gemara Bava Kamma deals with it. Our Gemara deals with it through a pasuk, which suggests that the obligation is only incumbent on the parent, not on the child. But again, if you say that the machloket here is not about whether the action is successful or not, it's a lot easier to understand the subsequent Gemara as to why the children are exempt. So now, the Gemara says, what does Rabbi Yochanan, hay v'chei achicha imach, may yavid lei? What does Rabbi Yochanan do with the pasuk of v'chei achicha imach? Suppose Rabbi Elazar does not need to answer Rabbi Yochanan's proofs. Here, Rabbi Yochanan really does need to answer Rabbi Elazar's proof because that's really in the parshia of interest. And it's a straightforward statement, a drasha that seems very likely or plausible. And Rabbi Yochanan has to address it. Look at Tanya. This is a braita, a very famous braita. Shnaim sheyu melchim baderech. Two people that are walking, traveling together. B'yad echad mehem kiton shalmayim. One of them had a flask of water. Im shotim shnehem meitim. They both will pass away. There is insufficient water for both of them to survive their travels or to make it to the civilized area where they can get more water. And therefore, if they share it now, they both will pass away. Bim shoteach ad mehem, if one of them drinks it, magi al yishuv, he'll make it back to civilization, he will survive. So a choice between both of them dying and one of them surviving. Darash ben petora, mutav shiishtu shnehem v'yamutu. Better that they both drink it and pass away. Val yireach ad mehem b'mitato shel chaveiro. So that you don't see the death of the other one. You should not be the cause of the death of the other party. So you share it as long as you can share it together. And in that way, you both did as best as you could in the circumstance. And if in the end you both pass away, in a sense it's a passive passing away because nobody caused the other person's death. If one was to take the water, then he would kill, in essence, the other person. Not actively, but in a sense he's withholding the ability for that person to live. Ad shebar Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva came along, but he made and taught b'chei achicha imach, chayecha kodmim l'chayei chavercha. So Rabbi Akiva darshens this pasuk to tell you b'chei achicha imach means with you. With you means first you, then them. They have to live with you. If you can't live, then there's no obligation for you to ensure that the other person lives. So your life takes precedence over another person's life. So the person holding the water, therefore, would have the right to drink the water. And then if the other person passes away, it's not on his head because there's no obligation to help him because of the fact that his life takes precedence. The bigger question is, what's the logic behind Ben Betorah's shita? In that Rabbi Kiva seems to us much more logical, obvious, that v'chei achicha imach is that you take precedence, and if you have more, then you help the other person out. Why should it be that you have to give up your life for someone else's life that won't be a life either? Because in the end, he's going to pass away. So your sacrifice, in a sense, doesn't benefit because neither of you will live in that circumstance. So what is the logic behind Ben Petorah? So the Ritva and others bring the logic that v'chei achicha imach means on a level plane. In v'chei achicha imach, he will live with you. So whatever you're entitled to, he's entitled to. So the same rights that you have, the other party has as well. The idea of v'ahavta d'reacha kamocha, that there is this obligation of parity between you and your fellow Jew. And v'ahavta l'rechah kamocha will demand here that you treat him the same way that you would treat yourself. So almost ironically, Rabbi Akiva, who is known as the Tana, who says that kol haTorah kula is summarized in v'ahavta l'rechah kamocha, in the end is arguing on that principle when Ben Petorah invokes it over here and says v'ahavta l'rechah kamocha would suggest that you both share the water and you both pass away. Rabbi Akiva says that's not the case. V'ahavta l'rechah kamocha is qualified by this statement, v'chei achicha imach, which means that you have to take precedence. It's good to be v'ahavta l'rechah kamocha when both of you can be beneficiaries of whatever it is. But if your sacrifice leads to both of you losing out, then there's no obligation of v'ahavta l'rechah kamocha, which might answer also why the pasuk of v'chei achicha imach is found here. Why is it found in the middle of a situation speaking about interest or charging of interest? So for Rabbi Elazar, it makes a lot of sense. It's telling you, v'chei achicha imach means you have to return the interest. But for Rabbi Akiva or for Rabbi Yochanan, who explains v'chei achicha imach He's speaking about an issue where they're at risk in life. What does it have to do with charging of interest? So actually, the Gemara does invoke it also in Baba Kama with regards to tzedakah or the giving of money, which is again, the obligation to take someone, when he falls on hard times and to take care of them, is as long as you're not impoverishing yourself. You don't have an obligation to lend money to someone else or to give them tzedakah if that will impoverish yourself. You have to first take care of yourself, your family, and then you have an obligation to give the excess to the ani or to help out other people. Obviously, there is a subjective nature there as to what is considered your basic necessities and what is an excess, and that might be the challenge for many of us, is to determine what we need versus what we can give to others. But there still is an obligation in the same way. This is a broader statement. It's not just about life and death. It's a statement about any time you engage in tzedakah and a mitzvah of chesed and giving to others, that there's an obligation that you take care of yourself first and not give to the other party. That's one way to look at it. The Chazon Ish adds on that the ability for the individuals to both live chaye sha'ah supersedes the ability of one individual to live chaye olam, so that the value of chaye sha'ah for each individual overrides the opportunity of chaye olam for one. Now, even though the Gemara in Avodah Zarah makes it clear when there's a trade-off between chaye olam and chaye sha'ah that we always opt for chaye olam and it supersedes the chaye sha'ah, the Chazon Ish indicates over here that neither party has a precedence, according to Ben Petorah, to the Chaye Olam. They both have the opportunity for Chaye Olam, and they both have the opportunity for Chaye Sha'ah. And since it is a stalemate in terms of that, we opt for the Chaye Sha'ah for both of them, so that they both should get that benefit of the Chaye Sha'ah, rather than giving one Chaye Olam and the other one nothing. So here's this machloka between Rabbi Kiva and Ben Petorah, as to who gets precedence over here with regards to the drinking of the water. So now the Gemara asks, this is what I discussed before that we had seen in Baba Kama. Their father left over to them monies of ribit. Even though the children know that these are monies of interest, they have no obligation to return them. Ha! What you would learn from this, the girsa change by the Bach, is that inhu de einan chayavin achzir, they are not obligated to return it. Ha avihen chayav lachzir. The diuk you would make is that the children have no obligation to return it, but the father has the obligation to return it. That would be supportive of Rabbi Elazar's position over here, that there is an obligation to return the interest. Where it says, b'dinu davuna nami lo mechayav lachzir. The truth is that their father also does not have an obligation to return it. So then, why did the Braita suggest that it's their children that don't have the obligation? But aidi dekai bayi the mitna seifa. It has to do with the latter half of that braita. If he leaves over for them a cow or some sort of beged, something that is clearly identifiable as a stolen object, there, even though in terms of gzelah, they don't have to return the object, there's no obligation on the children to return the object, here, because of the kavod of their father, where the object is clearly identifiable as a object that was stolen, it's theft, then they have to return it, because otherwise everybody sees the object and says, oh, that's that stolen item that he took from so-and-so that hasn't been returned. So they have to do out of the kavod of their father, they have to give it back. So tananami reisha bididhu. So therefore the reisha also speaks about the children's obligation. So the children's obligation in the latter half of the braita is specifically an obligation on them that they don't have in other situations. There's other situations they have no obligation to return it. In this one particular instance, they do have an obligation to return it. Since it spoke about the children in the latter half of the braita, it also spoke about the children in the earlier half of the braita. But the truth is, even the father does not have an obligation to return it. And that's how Rabbi Yochanan will get out of this problem of this braita. Gemara now goes on to a sidebar, which it discussed in Baba Kama. Wait a minute. Why do these children have any obligation to return it? For the kavod, the honor of their father. Karikan v'nasib amcha lo tahor. You're not allowed to curse someone who is a nasi b'amcha in your nation. So the Gemara dashes on this. First of all, that it's not just by a nasi, it's by anybody. You're not allowed to curse them. But the Gemara dashes ba'osei ma'asei amcha, that the qualification of nasi b'amcha teaches you that he has to be doing the ma'asei amcha. He has to be acting properly. If a person's acting properly, then he's governed by these laws. If he's not acting properly, then there is no obligation to treat him in this manner. So here the father, who is a thief, and passed away a thief, because that's why the children still have the theft in their possession, why do they have any obligation for kvod aviem, to honor their father, to return the item? Their father, in a sense, wasn't even worried about his own honor. He wasn't acting in an appropriate manner, and therefore there's no restriction of lo ta'or, you should not curse them, but certainly in this case, where it'd just be a denigration to their father's name, why should they have to return the item? Kedamar Rabbi Pinchas, Mishmei Derova. You can see here on the sides that they have different girsaot, as whether it's Rav Papa Mishmei Derova, or is it Rav Pinchas Mishmei Derov. So they're all different girsaot over here as to who was the Bala Memra. B'sha'asa tshuva. It's a case where he did tshuva. Hachanami, so to our case of here, is b'asa tshuva. He did tshuva. I'asa tshuva, my ba'igabe. He did tshuva, why is the theft still in the possession of the children? He should have given it back already. Shloi speak, lechzir adshemet. He did tshuva, but he didn't have sufficient time to rectify everything before he passed away. Therefore, the theft was still in his possession. So now, the Tosfot points out over here, the manda mar ribit ktsutza yotza b'dayanim. According to Rabbi Elazar, who says that ribit midoraita is taken out by the dayanim, parech shapir, shayelo lechzir. Then the question is fair as to why he didn't return it. But afilu lamanda amar eno yotza, even according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says that you don't return it, mikom akom havelo lechachzir mishum laz uboshet, they should have returned it because of the bad name and the embarrassment that it causes him. Became into lo chashash, since he didn't do it, gam banav ein lehem nachush lichvodo. If he didn't worry about his own kavod and his own boshet about returning it, even though the courts could not interfere and the courts could not demand that he return it, nevertheless, if it's about his honor, about his boshet, then he should have taken the initiative and returned it. The fact that he didn't worry about his own boshet, we don't obligate the children to worry about his own boshet. The answer of the Gemara is, lo he speak. He would have done it, he just didn't have sufficient time to do it after he had done tshuva. Okay, now meitave. So you bring another case from Baba Kama. Hagazlanim umalvei ribit. Thieves and those that lend with interest. Afopi shigavu, even though they've collected it already, machzirin, they have to return it. Gazlanim, my afopi shigavu ika. What type of, if they collected it, is it? Igazul, gazul. If they stole it, they stole it. Ilo gazul, gazlanim karitlu. They didn't steal it, then they're not called gazlanim. There's no collection here with regard to a gazlan. A gazlan either stole or he didn't steal. Those are the only two options you have. So that modifier in the Braita makes no sense, because gazlanim are not defined by whether they collected or they didn't collect. They're only defined by whether they stole or they didn't steal. Ella, Ema, you have to amend the Braita to read this way. Gazlanim, when it comes to thieves, umay nihu, what is the definition of a gazlan? Malvei ribit, those that are lending with interest. Afu pishu gavu machzirin, even though they already collected the interest, they have an obligation to return it. So it's gazlanim, colon, malvei ribit. And then when are you a gazlan by malvei ribit? Afu pishu gavu. Once you collected it, then you have an obligation to return it. Again, this would be very supportive of Rabbi Elazar's position. So Gemara says, tanaihi. It actually is a machloket tanaim, the Tanya. Rabbi Nechemia, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, putrim et amalveh, vet ha'areif, mipnei sheyesh behem kum asei. That Rabbi Nechemia and Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov believe that the malveh, the lender, harev, the guarantor, mipnei sheyesh behem kum asei, they are turim because they have an obligation, an asei. The asei being the obligation to return it. And therefore it becomes a lav anitak li asei. My kum asei, what is this kum asei that we're talking about? La mishum darminu kum ahaduru. Isn't the asei because we obligate them to return the monies that they took? Michlal, from that you would infer the Tanakama Savar lav bnei adure ninu. The Tanakama, who they are arguing on, believes that there is no obligation to return it. So that would be the machloket Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yochanan over here, that the obligation to return it has impact on the standing of these individuals. So it is a nitak le'asei that you're not allowed to charge interest. If you do charge interest, there is an obligation to return the interest. That obligation to return the interest makes it into a lav hanitak le'asei. And therefore, the malveh and the arev are paturim from malkot. they're not going to get Malkot over here because 11 Itakli Aseh is not subject to Malkot. On the other hand, if you believe there's no obligation to return it, then once you violate the Lav, then there is Malkot because it's not 11 Itakli Aseh. There's no obligation to return it afterwards. So the Gemara is suggesting that their Machloket as to whether you get Malkot, which is dependent on whether it's 11 Itakli Aseh or not, will be parallel to the Machloket of Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yochanan. The Gemara says, lo, my Kumaseh, what is the Kumaseh that was being read here? Likroa Shtara, to rip up the Shtar. So now, where the Gemara went right now is actually Machloket Rashi and Tosafot as to what the Gemara's assumption is. Now, Rashi says, lo means, la'olam emelacha imgava divrei hakol einu mitukan b'chazara min ha-malkot. Everybody agrees that you can't rectify the Malkot, ein kan nitak l'aseh. There is no nitak l'aseh over here. Which means that Rashi believes, and that's what Tosafot points out, that Rashi means everybody's holding like Rabbi Yochanan now. When the Gemara says lo, now it's saying everybody believes like Rabbi Yochanan, there's no obligation to return it. Then what is their machloket about? That's what the Gemara is about to explain once you've established that they're all holding like Rabbi Yochanan. Whereas the Bali and Tosafot disagree because the Gemara brought a question on Rabbi Yochanan, and then it says to answer the problem of Rabbi Yochanan, it says it is a machloket tanaim in order to support him. But then it comes along and says, you know what? According to Rashi, it's not a machloket tanaim. All the tanaim hold like Rabbi Yochanan. So then, koshkein damalei shapir tvei. Then why is there a problem for Rabbi Yochanan at all? If everybody or all the other tanaim hold like Rabbi Yochanan, then how can you ask or suggest there's a question from the other braita that we brought before? And so therefore, the Bali Tosafot want to suggest that the conclusion of the Gemara is that they're not arguing Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yochanan's position, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they all hold like Rabbi Yochanan. I mean, Eish Lomar, Dimikara Vadai Savar Depligei, Belav, Daltikach Mito Neshech. That they are arguing in the Pasuk that says, Altikach Mito Neshech Vitarbit, Vayereta Melokecha, Vechea Chicha Imach. Upligei be Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Lazar. That's what the Gemara thought. Umesik. And the Gemara's conclusion is, Tukulu Itlohu de Rabbi Lazar. Everybody holds like Rabbi Lazar, velo lucky, and they don't get malkot alav the altikach mimishum the nitak leasehu. Everybody agrees it's a nitak leaseh. Aval pligi be lav the lotisimun. They're arguing about the other lav, which is lotisimun alav neshech. Im kesef kavet ami et eni imach lotielekun oshe lotisimun alav neshech. That you cannot place neshech on him. It's a case where he did not yet collect the rebit. The Tanakama believes as soon as you write the shtar, that makes you obligated in. Versus the Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Nechemiah who believe otherwise. But then he says that the Gemara's continuation, the questioner didn't understand this. But you see a big difference here between Rashi and the Tosafot. Rashi says when the Gemara says lo, it means that they both hold like Rabbi Yochanan. And then the Gemara is going to explain it according to Rabbi Yochanan Shita. The Bali Tosafot say when it says lo here, they both hold like Rabbi Elazar. And there is nitak le'aseh. The Bali Tosafot do something here, which is important, which is that the pasuk that we quoted was al tikach mito neshek v'tarbit. Al tikach sounds like you took. Don't take it from him. And then v'chei achicha imach is if you took it from him, you have an obligation to return it. There's a separate pasuk v'lotus simun alav neshek. Don't engage in charging interest. Over there, you could argue that is even without the actual giving of the interest, there's an obligation not to charge interest, not to set up a transaction that involves interest in it. And that comes to the question about the Gemara's assumption here that there is a lav and itak the assay, that is a lav that can be rectified by an assay. What can the assay rectify? Which of the lavin that you violate over here can it rectify? Again, interest involves multiple lavin, as we saw already in yesterday's daf. So when you say v'chei achicha amach, can you rectify all of the lavin through that assay? Or is it limited? Limited to al tikach mito neshek v'tarbit. That's Tosafot's view. The other Rishonim believe that the question only revolves around lo tisimun alav neshek. That is only about that pasuk. Because over here, you're involving different parties. And when it says here, potrin et malveh v'et arev, you have to understand why the guarantor has anything to do with this. Why is the guarantor obligated in this case? It's true that a guarantor, if he guarantees a loan that involves interest, that he might be in violation of a lav, but then why would he get Malkot? What active participation did he have in this situation? So yes, he can be involved in a lav, but who says that he would get Malkot, that he needs a lav and he takli aseh? For that reason, some people leave et arev out of the braita. They take that girsa out. For others, like Rashi explains that the arev is actively involved. It's what they call an arev kablan, where he becomes the first line. The malveh goes to the arev right away, and then the arev goes and collects from the loveh. So the malveh went to the arev, and the arev had to pay out money to him. Then the arev went back to the loveh and demanded that he pay the money. So that's how they were actively involved in the violation, because the arev actually gave interest to the malveh and then took interest from the loveh. So that's a way to solve that problem, to say why he's actively involved. But that involves, or the question is, what isur is it involved? Is it al tikach mito neshech v'darbit, or is it only lo tusimun alav neshech? Again, which is an easier lav to violate, because there it doesn't seem like you need to actually take the money. It's simply that you engaged in a transaction that involved interest. So now, the Gemara says, lo, that that's not their machloket, but rather, what is their machloket about? My kumvasei, the kumvasei here is the crash shtara, to rip up the shtar. My kasavar, what do they hold? Ikasavar shtaru made the gavot ki gavuidami. If you're holding a document that entitles you to payment, it's the equivalent of as if collected, then you're done already. Huh? Avid isurayu. They already violated the isur, because if you look at the contract as if collected, then it's as if they took the interest already. Ilav ki gavuidami. If it's not as if collected, halo avud v'lo klum. They didn't take any action. Where's the maaseh that they're going to be chayav for? They hold that a shtar is not considered as if collected. And it's telling us the shuma miltahi, that engaging in the assessment of interest isn't in itself a problem. That the obligation, or obligating someone, or entering a transaction to pay you interest, in and itself is a violation. Hachanami mistabra, that makes sense. It's not, because we have a mishnah. Further on, ve'elo avrim belotase. These are the people who are in violation of belotase. Hamalveh, haloveh, harei, va'idim. That the people who are in violation of this problem of charging interest is the lender, the borrower, the guarantor, and the witnesses who sign on to this contract. Bishlama kulu avud masse. All of them took action, and again, I explained to you before how the arev could be involved in an action. But el-edim, my avud, edim are just witnesses. They never did anything that's active that should make them in violation of the lotaseh. Al-alav, shmamina, deshuma miltahi. What you must say is, the assessment of interest in and of itself is an obligation, or violates the issue of taking rebit. Because that's what's happening over here. The lotaseh over here that they're violating is even at the time that they extend the loan. And the edim are involved in the creation of the loan, or the ability for the loan to be outstanding. So shma mina, you see from this that shuma is considered to be a pivotal point. And then that's the machloket over here between the Tana Kama and Rabbi Nechemiah and Rabbi Eliezer, is how far along is it to be in violation of the shuma. So the Tana Kama believes that as soon as you create the loan, you create a circumstance in which interest will be charged, at that moment you are in violation. Now Rabbi Lezer and Yaakov and Rabbi Nechemiah can't argue on that, because again, then how do you solve the problem of the Edim? So there has to be a violation. But what they will say is, it is a violation retroactively if the interest is paid. But if the interest is never paid, then nothing actually happened. The Shuma itself is only significant if it follows through with the payment of interest. On the other hand, if it never falls through with the payment of interest, then the shuma is not significant enough. Whereas the Tana Kama believes that the shuma on a standalone basis is sufficient grounds to be mechayev. And therefore, the solution to the problem is to rip up the shtar. So according to the Tana Kama, ripping up the shtar does nothing for you, because the actual extension of the loan to the parties with interest on it, you violated at that moment. For Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, Rabbi Nechemiah, you're only in violation if you actually, after that assessment, actually go and collect on the loan. So if you rip up the shtar before you ever collect on the loan, then you've undone whatever violation could have been there, and that's why it's a lav hanitak liaseh, because still action is taken to, I would say, solidify that which was extended, the interest demand, then there is no violation. And so the assay, or gripping up the shtar, will rectify the situation. All right, so now, Amar Rav Safra, kol she'ilu b'dinehem motzi'in milove l'malve, anything where, under the secular courts, they would extract the money, meaning that if someone lent money in this manner, they would go after the borrower and force him to pay it, b'dinenu makzirin mimalve l'love. Then under our laws, we would force the malveh to return it to the loveh. So now, the classic example, which the Gemara will give in a second, I'm just using this to explain, which is that if you charge interest, under secular law, if you extended a loan to the borrower with interest, the courts will enforce that loan. You're allowed to charge interest under secular law, and therefore the courts will come and demand that the borrower pay not only the principal amount, but also the interest. So that is something that in their system, they would extract from the borrower and give to the lender. So what Rav Safra suggests is, if that's what they do, they will extract it, then you have to give it back. A malveh who did that under Jewish law would have to return the monies. So kol she'ilu b'dinehem ein motzi'in milovel malveh. On the other hand, something under their laws, where they would not demand that the borrower pay to the malveh, in our case, if the person paid such type of interest, we would not compel him to return it. So, Amar le Abaye the Rav Yosef, v'kololohu, is this really a general principle? The principle that he's trying to establish is ribit ktsutza, which is absolute ribit, which would be enforced by the secular courts. So then, under our law, you'd have to return it. Versus avak ribit, which is not enforceable in the secular courts. In that situation, we wouldn't demand that you have to return that which you took. So now the Gemara wants to understand, kolohu, is this really a principle that you can stand on? Vare sa'a bisa'a. A case of sa'a bisa'a, which is avak ribit, it's only ribit the Rabbanan, where you lend someone a sa'a worth of wheat, and he's going to return it to you at a later date. Dibidihem motzim milo ve'adam alveh. Over there, in the secular law, if you lend someone a bushel of wheat, they're going to come back and demand that you pay back the bushel of wheat. It doesn't matter if the price is shifted or not. They're going to demand that you pay it back. By us, we would not demand that the malveh, the lender, disgorge the profits that he made there because it's only avak ribit. It was only ribit midrabanan. And even Rabbi Elazar agrees that the obligation to return ribit is only when it's deoraita, not when it is derabanan. And this is avak ribit. Amalei inu b'torat pigadon ataliyade. Well, they view it not as interest there, they view it as a deposit. This is very interesting, which is that the Gemara here is going to, in a number of cases, say that the circumstance or the situation, even though we consider it or it looks like ribit, the truth is that it's not exactly ribit. And for that reason, the secular courts enforce it not because they think it's interest charge and they enforce interest charges, but rather, they view the whole case as being completely outside the world of interest. So for instance, over here, where you give the individual a bushel of wheat and he's expected to give you back a bushel of wheat, they don't look at that as an interest charge. And that's why they're forcing him to give it back. They look at it as a deposit. He deposited a bushel of wheat with you, and you have to return the deposit of that bushel of wheat to the party that gave it to you. So since they view it as a pikadon, they enforce the returnability. They're not enforcing it because they think it's okay to charge interest in this case. They don't even see it as a case of interest. So therefore, it's not under the rubric of the position that Rav Safra suggested. Rav Safra suggests when they collect because it's interest, we disgorge it because it's interest. Where they don't collect because of its interest, then we don't force you to disgorge it. This they don't view as a case of interest. They simply view it as a case of pikadon, a deposit. Amar le Ravina the Ravashi, Vare Mashkanta below Nechaita. Wait a minute, what about this mechanism, which is if you give collateral without deduction? Dibidinem motzim milovel malveh. Over there, by their dinim in the secular courts, they'll force the borrower to pay the lender. The situation or circumstance is where he collateralizes something in order to borrow the money. So say he mortgages his field, he mortgages his vineyard in order to take out the loan and guarantee the loan. The field is productive in the interim. The field produces grapes, the field produces grains. Who gets that value? So in a case of mashkanta belo nechaita, it's a mashkon with no deduction. You could have it that the field's production, in a sense, defeases the loan. which is as it produces, the malve, the lender, will take that money, the value of what's created there, and then deduct it from the principal amount. In that case, that would be fine. The problem here is it's mashkon belo nechaita. He keeps that value, but he takes nothing off the loan. So in essence, what he's doing is he's charging him interest, that he gets the production of the field that's put up as a mashkon, and he deducts nothing from the loan. He doesn't defease the loan at all. That means he's going to get his full principal amount back, plus he's getting the production of the field in the interim. So that's a case of interest. So he says, in that case, in the secular courts, they'll enforce such an agreement and force the lovet to cough up the vineyard or the production of the vineyard or the production of the field. Yet, when it comes to us, ubidineinu ein makzirim malved lovet. If you set up such a structure, we would not force the malved to give it back to the lovet, because as Rashi says over here, avak ribitu. That's only ribit midrabanan. Kevin de zimnin sheino sim perot. There are sometimes when the field is not productive at all. Interest, and again, interest midoraita is a case where it's obvious that you're paying for it. It's not transactional. It's a borrowing or a lending transaction. And number two is you're guaranteed to get the payments of interest. Over here, it's not guaranteed you're going to get these payments of interest. The field could be non-productive. It could be there's a blight in 1 year and there's no production on the field. So that's not considered interest midoraita. It's only interest midrabanan, as Rashi says. And therefore, it would not be returned under our halacha. So Amalei, he says to him, inu b'torat zvine ata liyadayu. Once again, they don't view this as interest. They view this as a transaction. It's as if you bought the field temporarily. It's as if you leased the field. You lent him money. He gave you the field as collateral. But instead of viewing it as a loan, they view it as a sale with an option to buy it back. So they look at this as being a full sale, of course. When you buy it or you lease the ground, you're allowed to take the production from that item. But from our perspective, where we view it as interest, the cases are not parallel, because they're not forcing the payment because of interest. They're forcing the payment because they think there was a sale. And so therefore, you can't bring this as a proof or disproof to Rav Safra's position. Ella, what you have to say is, Kol Sheilu B'nehem Deka Amar Rav Safra May Atali Ashmi'inan. What exactly is the case by which Rav Safra is coming to teach us something about? Again, if it's ribit d'oraita, of course we know that they enforce ribit d'oraita because they allow the charging of interest, and we force you to cough it up, like Rabbi Elazar says. What did he add for us that we wouldn't have known? So it's ochi atali ashminan. This is what he came to teach us. Kol shilu b'dinayim motzim milove l'malveh b'dinayinu makzirin mimalveh l'loveh. That's the parallel that we draw before. Ma'niyu b'ribit kitzutza. That is when it's ribit d'oraita, where they will enforce such a thing and force the borrower to pay the lender. We will force you to disgorge those profits because that's ribit d'oraita ukid Rabbi Eleazar. And similar to the position of Rabbi Eleazar, he's paskening or upholding that position of Rabbi Eleazar. Kol shilu b'dayim, ein motzim b'dineinu, ein makzirin. What is the example of that, ma'nihu? Ribit mukdemet and ribit mi'ucheret. That is pre-loan interest and post-loan interest. The Mishnah later on in our perek will tell us that you're not allowed to preemptively give something or basically butter up the lender in order that he gives you a loan. For instance, you invite him over for a meal and say, I'm inviting you over because I want you to lend me money. So there you are prepaying the interest because you're not paying it once you have the loan, but it's clear that you're doing it in order to facilitate the loan. And the same thing afterwards. If you say to him, after you've repaid the loan, you say to him, because you lent me the money, why don't you come over and spend a couple of nights in our hotel? That is, again, ribit mi'ucheret. That is after-the-fact interest. Now, both of those are not interest midoraita. They are only interest midrabanan, because it's not done in the context of a loan. It's not done when there was an outstanding loan and you're paying interest on the loan. But it's clear that you have connected between the action, the activity that you're doing, and the loan that is there. And therefore, that connection makes it that it's mechsek ribit or avak ribit. It is deemed to be a type of interest payment because you're doing it only to facilitate the loan or because the person lent you money. Now, obviously, that is not endless, or it's not in a case where he doesn't specify or articulate it. Because someone lent you money, you can never invite them over your house anymore. No, it has to be that you associate the activity with the loan. It has to do with the machshava, or the intent of the individual. The person's intending through this action to cause the person to give him a loan or to thank him for giving him a loan, then there's a problem. If he simply does it because they were friends before and they were friends afterwards, then it's not a problem as long as it's not in the context of the loan or with the intent because of the loan. But here, it's Ribbit Rabbanan, and there the courts will not enforce it in their situations because there's no contractual obligation for interest over here. It was a prepayment or the assumption that you were going to get a loan, or as a postpayment. Over there, if the borrower made such a commitment, the courts or secular courts would not enforce it because it was not a contractual obligation of interest. So therefore, in our case, if you take such interest, which is interest in Rabbanan, you will not have an obligation to return it because Rabbi Elazar believes that Ribbit Ktutza, Midoraita, you have to return. If it's a violation of Midoraita, if it's a violation of Midorabbanan, of Ribbit, you don't have an obligation to return it. Again, it goes back to what we said in the beginning. You may not have an obligation to return it under the legal law that the courts can come and enforce it, but you might have an obligation, let's say, Idei Shamayim, that they argue about whether, according to this, does that mean you can just keep it and you're done because the person gave it to you willingly, or do you have an obligation, let's say, Idei Shamayim, to return the interest? And that's a discussion both in the Shita of Rabbi Elazar in the Rabbanan and the Shita of Rabbi Yochanan on the Doraita level. The court enforcements of returning of ribit, how far we do this is questionable. Rashi in the beginning of the sugya says, ribit ktutza, kofin oto beitin lagzir im tovo'o bechayav. If while he's still alive, you make a claim against him, then beitin will intervene to get the interest back. So what we're clear from Rashi is that beitin will not interfere unless the borrower asks them to interfere. He must make a claim in order for them to interfere. Beit Din won't simply come in and say, give back the interest. You weren't supposed to charge interest. No, if the borrower comes into court and says, I want my interest back, he shouldn't have charged me interest, then the courts will intervene in order to help him. That's the way Rashi views it. There are other Rishonim believe that not only do the courts intervene of their own volition, but they actually are Yorei Letoch Nechasav. They will confiscate property in order to return the interest. So on one side of the spectrum of Rashi, who says that only with a claim will they enter the fray. Others say that they'll enter the fray of their own volition. Not only will they only enter the fray of their own volition, they'll go and confiscate property. There are middle positions that say Beit Din will interfere of their own volition, but they won't confiscate property. They will demand that the person puts it back. But without a claim, they won't go and demand or confiscate property in order to have it repaid. So you have a spectrum amongst the Rishonim as to how involved the courts will be and whether you need the claimant to say something in order for the courts to interfere in the case. So there we saw what Rashi said, and then the Rishonim have crossed the spectrum about how much interference Beit Din, or how much Beit Din gets involved in forcing the return of such Ribbit Ktutza. All right, so now the Gemara continues on to discuss the latter case in our Mishnah, which is Ketzad. In the Mishnah it says, Ezehu Tarbit. What is considered to be tarbit, which the Gemara then told us is a isur ribit midrabanan, it's a vak ribit. What was the case? A case where he purchased from him chitim b'dinar zav for 25 dinare kesef, and then the price went up, but as the Mishnah notes, that was the going price at that time. He didn't take anything that he shouldn't have. He gave him money at a time that the market price was that way, and therefore was mutar legamre. Then, after a time, he wants his wheat back because the price of wheat has gone up and he wants to be able to sell it, to monetize it. The guy says, listen, I don't have wheat right now, but I accept the fact that I owe you 30 dinar and instead I'm going to pay you with wine. I'm going to give you wine in the future. When I have the wine, I'm going to give you the full value of your 30 dinar kesef that you deserve. There, the Mishnah says it's asur midrabanan, it's a vak ribit. What the Gemara wants to determine is what went wrong over here. Why is there a problem of ribit? Why is the second part of the case not just like the first part of the case? In the first part of the case where he had money, he gave him money and lent him the money in a sense, but he really purchased the wheat from him. So when he purchased the wheat from him, it was mutar because the market price was already set. So later on when he comes to claim the wheat from him and he says, listen, I don't have wheat, I owe you 30, let's just make it based on the wine. If the wine's market price is out also, then why isn't it the same situation where you can say to him, that's the market price of wine and he can do it? What's the difference between the latter half of that Mishnah for the first half of the Mishnah? Why is it asur over there? Now, Rashi views the first part of the transaction as being completely mutar. The chitim, the wheat aspect of the transaction being mutar. And when the Mishnah says asur, it's referencing the second part of the transaction, which is the wine part of the transaction. And that's what the Gemara is grappling with, which is, Why is it that the wheat part is mutar and the yayin part is asur? What's the difference between them? For that reason, Rashi actually explains, we're going to have three different explanations of the Mishnah. We're going to have an explanation from Rava, then a question from Abaye and his explanation, and tomorrow we'll deal with a third explanation, which is another explanation of Rava, or there's an alternate girsa that this was Rava and not Rava, and then that leads to a question as to whether the first and third answers are really the same answer. It's just a modification of the answer. And that the first and third answer are both answers of Rava and the same answer. According to Rashi, there are three different or separate answers. According to Bali Yatzel Sefot and other Rishonim, the first and third answers are actually the same answer. But they explain the question of the Gemara not just being on the wine part of the transaction, but even the wheat part of the transaction, the earlier part of the transaction. And they see the question as being much broader, and that's what leads to the explanations that derive from that question. So the Gemara says, "V'chi ein lo yayin mayhavi." What's the problem by the fact that he doesn't have wine at that time? V'atanyo ein poskim al pirot ad seyetzei ashar. One may not purchase for future delivery any type of produce until the market price has been stabilized. I mean, it's not the early market price. There's a full, easy market out there. If you want to buy at that price, you can buy as much as you want at that price because the market price is set now. Everybody's trading at that price. Yatsa Shar, if the price is at already, poskim, afal pi shein lezeh yesh lezeh. The reason behind this is because even if he doesn't have it, someone else has it. So this goes back to what we discussed earlier, last perek, the beginning of this perek, sa'ah b'sa'ah. When you lend someone a bushel worth of wheat or a sa'ah worth of wheat and expect to get a wheat return in the end, it is a problem of a vakri beat because we're worried about the fact that the cost of wheat might appreciate. And if that's the case, then when he returns you the bushel of wheat, he's returning you more value than you lent him. There are two exceptions we said to that. One exception is b'yeshlo. When the borrower has wheat in his possession, he just doesn't have accessibility to it. He doesn't have the liquidity to get to it. His son has the key. It is somewhere else. So he needs your help. In that case, you said it's fine because the replacement wheat is in a sense already in the hands of the lender. Because he has it in possession, as if he gave it to him. And when it appreciates in the possession of the lender because the borrower already has what he's going to return in possession. Or the other case is a case where the market price is set at that moment. That's because when you hand him the money today, he could, even though he doesn't have wheat to provide you today, he could walk into the market and buy it from a third party and supply you what he's supposed to supply you. Tosafot points out over here, the afagav delo mashach chitim. Even though he didn't make a kinyan on the chitim, nevertheless, since he could buy it from someone else, then he's subject to mishu para. Because someone gave him cash, and when he gave him cash, that is the equivalent of not being allowed to back out of the transaction. And even though there's no kinyan, which would make it that the chitim belonged to the person who gave him the money, nevertheless, the fact that he is governed by mishu para makes it chashive kin nityakru b'shut alokeach. It makes it as if he already owns the wheat that he could purchase with that money, and it is as if it went up in value in his possession. So Tosafot invokes the idea of Mishu Para to say despite the lack of a full-fledged kinyan, there still is an ability to assign whatever he purchases in the future or the appreciation in value to the individual who gave the money up front and bought it up front. So since that's the case over here, that's what the Gemara is saying. Wait a minute. If the market price is out, you can go buy it. If you can go buy it, there's no problem of hakribit. So why don't we say the same thing over here? If the market price was out for the wheat, and when he started the transaction, it worked, then by the yayin, why don't you say the same thing? The yayin, even though he doesn't have yayin, the market price was out. So why can't he establish a transaction like that and sell it for delivery in the future? Because he can acquire the wine today at that market price. So amarabo matnitan bebala chob bedmehen askinan. It's a case where he wants to obligate himself bidmehem in their value. Uched etanya, a similar braita. Reish noshe b'chaviro maneh. He was a creditor to his friend for maneh, which is 100 dinari kesef. Balach v'amad al gorno. He shows up at the borrower's threshing floor. V'omer tein li ma'utai. Give me my money. Shani rotzeh l'kach b'hem chitim. Because I want to purchase wheat with that money. I want you to return the money I lent to you because I want to buy wheat today. Amarlo, chitim yesh li, shani noten lecha. He says, I have wheat that in the future, once I process it, once I bring it in, I will be able to pay you with it. Let us figure out what the market price is today, and I will repay you, or I'll basically deliver you the wheat. You want your money to buy wheat, I'll deliver you the wheat at the price that is in the market today. And I will pay you back over the next 12 months. I will pay you your 100 dinar. I'll pay you your money back through delivery of wheat. Asur. It is restricted. The lav ki isaro abadiyado domi. Because it's not the equivalent of having money in hand. So what Rabba is suggesting now is the explanation of the Mishnah is that there's a difference between when you have money in hand versus when you don't have money in hand. The exemption from a vakri beat is in a case or a situation in which, like you just mentioned, he got money. He purchased it. He made a forward purchase. He says, I'm handing you money for wheat that I want you to deliver in 6 months from now at the price that is in the market today. The person could take that money right now, even though he doesn't have wheat on hand, and go buy it in the market at that price and then deliver it to him in 6 months. That's fine. He could do that. But that's because you handed him cash. And he had the cash in order to execute on that transaction. The problem is, in the case that we just noted in the Braita, it's a case where he already owed him the money. The money was lent to him in a totally separate transaction. He lent him a manet in a different transaction. Now the creditors come in and say, give me my money back. The borrower doesn't necessarily have that money in hand to pay him back. And he says, you know what, I don't have the money to pay you today, but I'll pay you in wheat, because that's what you want to buy anyway. When he does that, he does not really have the option to go into the market and purchase the wheat at that price, because he doesn't have cash. If he had cash, he would be paying back the lender the cash right now. The fact that he doesn't have cash in hand makes it that he is flipping the loan into the wheat. But when he flips the loan into the wheat, he's doing it on credit because he has no ability to buy it in the market now. And that means that he's basically assuming the risk. He could not replace that which you're asking him in the market because he doesn't have money to go in the market. And that's the problem in the Mishnah. As the way Rashi explains it is that by the case of wheat, originally when he lent him the money, when he gave him the money, he gave him money. So since he gave him money, he could go into the market and purchase the wheat. He chose not to, but that's what he could do. When the guy comes back and says, I want my wheat now because it's worth a lot more and I want to sell it. The guy says, you know what? Forget about it. I'll give you the wheat back at that price. But then I want to flip that into wine because you wanted to monetize it and buy wine. I want to flip it into wine. So in that case, it is lav ki yisro abadi yado domi. Then it's not like he has money in hand. And since he has money in hand, he can't flip it into wine and say, I'll give you wine at today's market price. Because he couldn't purchase it at today's market price. He doesn't have cash in hand to make that purchase. So Amar le Abaye, e delo ki yisro abadi yado. If it's not like he got cash in hand, my area ain't low. Why does it matter if he doesn't have it in hand? Afilu yesh lo nami. Even if he has it in hand, it would still be problematic. You're saying to me the problem here is the lack of cash changing hands. It's because there was an outstanding loan that you're flipping into this item. That's what the problem is. Abaye says back to Rava, then why does it matter that he has wine or he doesn't have wine? The Mishnah specifies that the problem with the wine is ain't low. He doesn't have it. Since he doesn't have it, we have a problem now. But he says, in your explanation, it's irrespective of whether he has it in hand or not, because the problem is there's no cash here. If there's no cash, even if he has the yayin in hand, we won't allow you to do this based on what Rav is saying, is because you're flipping the loan into payrot. You're flipping it into something else. And even if you have it in possession, that won't work. Because the Braita says that you're not allowed to do that, Afilo Medo Garno. Even he's standing on the threshing area of this individual who's providing the wheat, it says it doesn't work, even though Yeshto, even though he has the produce to supply it, nevertheless, it still is restricted when he doesn't have the cash in hand and he's trying to do it through a debt conversion. So Bayez says your answer doesn't fit well into the Mishnah or the language of the Mishnah, which specifies only if you don't have wine does it not work. Had you had wine, it would have worked just fine. But your problem or your explanation says it's problematic not because of whether you do or don't have wine. It's problematic because you simply are not taking cash at that time. You're flipping an existing loan into this transaction. And that's what causes the problem. Because basically, in what essence you're saying is I'm extending the loan and I'm paying you more for extending the loan because of the fact that I'm flipping it into this new produce. So now, Rabba's problem is the language of the Mishnah. According to Rashi, that's going to lead to a Abaye's explanation and an alternate explanation from Rava later on. According to the Balei HaTosafot, many of the Rishonim, the problem with Rabbah Shita is the language of the Mishnah versus the Baraita, which seems to indicate otherwise. And what Rabbah is going to do is uphold or stay with his position, but then he's going to just tell us that there's another reading of the Mishnah. Rabbi Hoshaya, who explains this Mishnah in his Braitot, in his Tosefta, has a slightly different language, and that different language is supportive of Rabbah's position. So according to many Rishonim, that next statement, or letter, tomorrow's daf, when we speak about the third explanation, or Rabbah's explanation, that's just a continuation of what he says now. He's just addressing Abaye's problem with the fact that it doesn't fit the language of Mishnah by saying that's not a problem. I have a Tosefta that says, or acts differently, and I will rely on that. According to Rashi, you have an answer of Rabbah, Abaye's rejection, Abaye's suggestion, then a rejection, and Rabbah gives a third answer, which is not connected to this answer. El Rama Abaye, Matznit and Kentani Rav Safra, Bibit, Debe Rabbi Chia. Abaye says, our Mishnah can be explained according to the way that Rav Safra brought down the Tosefta of Rabbi Chia, which is, the Tani Rav Safra, Bibit, Debe Rabbi Chia. Rav Safra brought down this Braita, or this Limud that comes out of Rabbi Chia that is Ribit. Yesh Tvarim Sheim Mutarin. There are things that are Mutar. Vasurim Mipnei HaRamat Ribit. They're Sur because they are, in a way, a conniving way to collect interest. They're not Ribit Midoraita. According to many, they're not even Ribit. They're Abanan. It's Mutar. But it's considered to be HaRamat Ribit. According to the Rambam, that means that if you collected it, you have no obligation to return it. There is no Easter involved. You shouldn't be doing this. But if you did it, it's Haramat Ribit, and that's it. According to Ramban, it's the equivalent of a Vak Ribit. Haramat Ribit is just another way to say that this is an Isur Drabanan on Ribit, but it's not an Isur Do'oraita. What is that? Ketzat. Amar lo hilvani maneh. Lend me a maneh. Amalei maneh ainli chitim bimaneh yeshli. Says, I do not have 100 zuz to give you, but I have wheat of that equivalent value that I'm willing to give you. Shani yatein lecha, and I'll give them to you now. Natan lo achitim bimaneh. He charges him 100 zuz to take the wheat. Now, obviously the guy, when he borrowed, he wanted to borrow cash. He did not want to borrow wheat. So now when you give him wheat, that's not exactly what he wanted. So how do we solve that problem? V'chazar v'lachanim enu be'atsrim v'arba sela. And he goes back and buys them back from him at 24 sela. 24 sela, every sela is 4 dinar. That is 96 dinarim. So he buys it back at a discount of 4% of 4 dinar. So what he does to facilitate the transaction without interest is not to lend him money and say, I'll lend you 96, you give me back 100. Rather, he made the whole thing a transaction. He says, I don't have 100 dinarim to lend you now. So instead, I'll give you wheat worth 100 dinar. And he hands it to him. Then the borrower goes ahead and sells the wheat. He sells it back to the person who gave him the wheat to start with, the length of the wheat to start with, but he sells it back at a price of 96. So in essence, the cash in hand for the person who is quote-unquote borrowing is 96. In the end, he's going to have to return wheat that is worth 100. So it's the equivalent of a loan for 100 and payment or receipt of cash of 96 and interest of 4. That's what it is, but he did it in a manner that makes it into a transaction rather than rebate when you're charging interest openly. So there it is, mutar. It is mutar to do such a thing because it's all transactional. But we don't allow it because it's clear that you are sidestepping the law. You are trying to circumvent the law by creating a transaction that essentially creates interest without charging interest in an outright manner. So instead of lending him cash, you lending him 96 and demanding 100 back, you lent him a full 100. But then when you purchased it back from him, you purchased it at a discount in order to facilitate the payment of interest. Hachanami. So too in our case of the Mishnah, you go into Amar, the cases. Hilvani shloshim dinarim. Said, lend me 30 dinar. Amarle, shloshim dinarim, ainli chitim shloshim dinarim yeshli. Says, I don't have 30 dinar to lend you, but I do have wheat worth 30 dinar to lend you. Shani noten lecha, that I'll give to you. Natan lo chitim shloshim dinarim. And he did that. He delivered him wheat worth 30 dinar, even though the guy didn't have the money at the time to pay for it. He lent it to him. V'chazar v'lachami menu b'dinar zahav. And then the lender of the wheat went back and repurchased the wheat for 25 dinarai kesef. Dinar zav is 25 dinarai kesef. So he bought it back at a discount. He bought it back at a 20% discount to the face value of the wheat. He gave him wheat that was worth 30 and he buys it back at 25. If the borrower has wine, diyayiv le b'shloshim dinar, that you can give to him for 30 dinar, pay rehu the kashakal minei. In the end, he's taking produce from him. The late lamban is no problem because it is considered to be a barter transaction. It's a transaction between parties for goods. Vilo, if he does not have wine on hand, gave him the late lechamra, vaday mishkal zuze minei. If he doesn't have wine on hand, in the end, what he's taking from him or collecting from him is money, is zuz, and mechzei kribit, and therefore it looks like ribit. Again, this is supportive maybe of the Ramban's position that haramat ribit is the same as mechzei kribit, the same as avak ribit, because here the Gemara uses the terminology of mechzei kribit. So in essence, if he had wine at the time, then he gave him money originally, and he's paying him back in wine. That looks like a transaction. That's fine, because it is a transaction where he's using money to purchase goods in the end, and that's fine. In the case where he does not have wine to repay it, in the end, he's going to have to give him cash. And if he's taking cash from him, then he's taking more cash than he lent him. So Amalei Rava, he says, Ihachi, if that's the explanation of our Mishnah, it's very hard. Tainli chiti, he says, give me back my wheat. Demei chiti mi bayile. He didn't want his wheat back. He wanted his money back. The way that you're explaining the case here is not that he lent him wheat in the beginning, and now he expects wheat back. So then he says, Tenli chitai, give me my wheat back. He's not asking for his wheat, he's asking for the value of the wheat back. He wants his cash back. Because the transaction is a monetary transaction now, not a transaction where he lent him wheat and is expecting wheat back in return. Then the language of the Mishnah is very difficult. Because the Mishnah says, Tenli chitai, give me my wheat back. But he doesn't have wheat from him. He has money from him. He has value from him that he has to return. It should be demechitai mi bayile. I want the value of my wheat back. Tnei, amend the Mishnah to read demechitai. Just amend it. Shani mochran. It says that I want to sell them. Shimichartim lecha mi bayile. Not that I want to sell them now. That I sold to you should be the way that he has it. In that he says that I sold it to you up front. Because the reason that he has cash now is that he sold them the wheat up front and then he bought it back from him. So the buying it back is what generated the cash in this situation. So that means that he owes him cash, not wheat. So it should say demei chitai. Number two is it should not say that I want to sell the wheat that you owe me. He already sold the wheat that he owed him. So again, it should be in the past tense. That I sold you already. He meant the Mishnah to say that I already sold you. Your wheat will be converted into 30 dinar. Wait a minute. From the outset, that was the value of the wheat that he had given him. What do you mean? I'm accepting them at the price of 30 today. He already accepted them at 30 from the outset of the transaction. Remember, the transaction was a case where he handed him the higher price of wheat, and then the guy sold it back to him at a discount. So he handed him 30 dinar kesef worth of wheat, and then he bought it back from him at 25. So now, first of all, it's demei chitai. It's the value of the monies that I lent you for the chitai that I paid. That's 25. Number two is the market price is not now 30. The market price was 30 at the outset of the transaction. And number three is, not that you want to sell it now to monetize it for 30. He already monetized it in the beginning of the transaction. So the Gemara again says, Achi kamarle, b'demei chitech shasit alai b'shloshim dinar. Harei elechai itzli behen b'yayin. V'yayin ain lo, and he has no wine. So he says, not that now I'm making it into the 30 I owe you, but rather, the monies of chitim that I originally got from you when the price was 30, I'm going to flip that 30 from the original price into wine. So again here, the Mara emended the Mishnah three times to have the language matched so that it'll work for Abaye. Mara says, a number of problems with that. Vabadinar zav akur, v'chein ashar k'toni. You have two problems, which is that the language of the Mishnah is not supportive of this, which is, first of all, it says, habadinar zahav. It gave him wheat that was worth a dinar zahav, which was 25, and then it says, v'chein ashar, and that was the market price. So the Mishnah says that the market price at the outset of the giving of the money was 25 dinari kesef for the wheat. So that upends Abaye's whole explanation where the original case was 30, and he only bought it back for him at 25. No, the Mishnah says that he bought it at 25 because that was the market price for Chena Shah. And therefore, it's very hard to put Abaye's explanation into the Mishnah. Again, we amended parts of the language all the way along to try to make it fit. But here we bump into a dead end, which is that the Mishnah explicitly says that he purchased it for 25 dinari kesef, and that was the market price. It wasn't that the market price was 30 at that time. And therefore, Elo Amar Rava. We're going to come back and now have an alternative explanation of Rava. Again, the possibility is that the Girsa here is Rava and not Rava. Then that would solve the problem as to why you have three different shitot over here, and Rava is coming back to give a different shita. On the other hand, if it is Rava, then you have to explain what's changed between what was said before in Rava and what is said now. Okay, we're going to stop here. The second to last line on Samach Bet, Amud Bet.